Every Monday morning, we hear the reports of weekend violence.
In the first 100 days of this year, nearly 900 people have been shot in the city of Chicago.
Shooting of a man in broad daylight in the streets of Chicago, apparently captured on his own camera phone.
It's not a video game. You don't get an extra life. Once you're dead, you're dead.
Does that coverage really inform us about what's happening, and how much does it reinforce stereotypes about parts of Chicago, especially its South Side? Overcoming those stereotypes is part of the point behind Chicago journalist Natalie Moore's new book. We'll talk about the South Side, a portrait of Chicago and American segregation, coming up this hour on the 21st. Also, we'll fill you in on what you missed this weekend in Illinois politics and look ahead as lawmakers head back to Springfield yet again this week. That's coming up all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Segregation is crippling because it's the common denominator to many challenges in Black communities, whether we're talking about violence, housing, jobs, education, even access to food. The unofficial separate but equal isn't working out too well for us. So writes Chicago journalist Natalie Moore in her new book, The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. Her book attempts to break down the stereotypes and to get beyond the language we often use to describe the South Side of Chicago. It's a detailed portrait of a place Natalie Moore knows intimately because it's her home. This is an issue Natalie has been covering, well, since even before she was a classmate of mine back at Northwestern University, which is when I first met her. She even helped narrate a tour of her South Side where she grew up for all of us at MDL. Today, we're going to talk about the nuances of life on Chicago's South Side and how much it reflects modern segregation in America. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet to 21st Show. Natalie, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
So if we think about this, Natalie, it's Monday morning. And every Monday morning in the summer, you and I know this drill well from our time at WBEZ. You see the headlines of tallies of violence. And I think it tends to reinforce this notion that Chicago is the so-called murder capital of America, which isn't exactly what the New York Times said yesterday. And it's a very extensive coverage of Memorial Day weekend. But I wonder what you think about particularly that piece yesterday, but also sort of if you can take a step back at the way that we're reporting violence, particularly in Chicago, and what you think that says about the problem.
I've always had an issue with the way violence is covered, and it's hard because shouldn't these type of things be covered? But if you don't have balance of coverage in those violent neighborhoods, it gives the impression that that's the only thing that's there. And the Monday morning roundup, you know, we all just wait and brace ourselves for the numbers, and then we report them. And you don't see this happening in other cities. And Chicago does have more murders than any other city in the country, but it is not the murder capital. The equalizer, if you do per capita murders, it would be a different number. But nonetheless, we lack a lot of nuance in the collective media coverage and unpacking some of the issues about why there is violence. And as far as the New York Times piece goes, before I had even seen it, people were emailing me like, hey, what are your thoughts on this? It was very well written, and it did put a human face to violence. But it didn't tell you anything about the neighborhoods. It didn't tell you anything about how guns get there. It didn't tell you about any of the challenges in the neighborhoods. To me, it felt like reporting in a vacuum, and I don't know if people learned anything new besides what they already know, that there are some violent places in Chicago where Black people live, and those can turn into stereotypes because people, if that is their only interaction or intersection with those neighborhoods because they don't visit or don't know anyone, they're going to think that it's just a Wild Wild West shootout in those neighborhoods all the time when there are people who are trying to better their neighborhood, there are block clubs. You know, these are places where people live and they're filled with humanity.
When we think about that, Natalie, I wonder, I think for people outside of Chicago, I wonder how much they see headlines about Chicago and wonder why Chicago ends up being so much of a focus. And I wonder how much of you think when we talk about, I want to talk about national media first before we get to local media, how much of that you think, and even international coverage. Natalie, I can't count how many times you've been pulled to be on the BBC or other international news outlets to talk about violence in Chicago. And how much of that do you think is simply because people see this as President Obama's hometown and therefore a national and international story?
I absolutely think that, and I'm trying to blame Obama for the city's problems, but because this is his hometown, I believe that has brought attention. One example with the BBC, there was a shooting a few years ago in a park on the city's southwest side, and no one died. And I was asleep when it happened, and I get a call in the wee hours in the morning from the BBC asking me to be on. I said, well, I wasn't there. But one, I thought it was peculiar that they were even interested in a story about a shooting at a park where there were no fatalities. And when I did go on to try to use this opportunity to contextualize the issues of violence, the first thing they said was, so, reporting from Barack Obama's hometown, here's Natalie Moore. So, you know, this that lends credence to my theory that Obama is the focal point as to why there's attention. And then media sometimes acts like a pack. And if they see one media outlet covering something, others tend to follow. So there is a little bit of a herd mentality that's there.
I'm speaking with WBEZ Chicago Southside reporter Natalie Moore. She's the author of a new book. It's called The Southside, A Portrait of America, of Chicago and American Segregation. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can tweet us at 21st Show. Natalie, can maybe you I think you should contextualize for us. When we look at the violence, when we look at this year in particular in Chicago, how do you think people should what do you think people should know about, first of all, about the numbers and its place in Chicago's history?
Well, this, if we go back to history, Chicago has always been a violent city, and that's not an excuse, but it, we need to understand our history. When I was reporting my book, I have a chapter about violence, and it's called We Are Not Chirac, which is the play off of Chicago in Iraq, which is a nickname for the city. And even back in the turn of the century, Chicago had more murders than New York or L.A., and a lot of that had to do with the mob presence, prohibition, and even back in the early 20th century, the Tribune had a clock that was counting the murders, similar to how we see murders being counted today. So that was actually pretty stunning to look at old Tribune articles and to see that.
Well, and you have in the book, there's passages you pull from Tribune stories from the 70s or even earlier, and it almost seems like the exact same story that's being written today.
Right. So one, we've been violent, and that was white violence. And Khalil Muhammad has a book called The Condemnation of Blackness, where he does talk about Chicago, but how violence became racialized. When that violence was happening in Chicago, it was among ethnic white immigrants, and it was seen as society's problems. And you had settlement workers helping, and you had this looked at as a collective city issue. When blacks were violent, it was looked at, well, black community, that is your issue. And there were fewer resources. You didn't have the same settlement house. When I say settlement house, think Jane Addams. You didn't have that type of help on the South Side. And so it was looked at as contained. And that's still sort of the mentality today. The violence that we see in black neighborhoods are ones that have high poverty, high crime, high unemployment, and you know that's not by accident that you have communities that are under-resourced and have those type of systemic problems that are going to have the kind of violence, gun violence that we've seen.
We're going to talk about all of those systemic problems, jobs, education, even access to food. But Natalie, I wanted to ask you about the term Chirac, because I think that that's a very controversial term in Chicago. There are activists who have fought and said, we refuse this label. We don't want this impression. But I wonder if you could explain a little of not just that label, but also the psychological effect that may have. You write in the book a little bit about media coverage of violence and how much that even impacts even children who live in those communities.
Yeah, Chirac is a term that popped out of a subgenre of rap culture known as drill music. And it was seen as a badge of honor, and there were some songs about it. And then it became embraced by youth, and now we even hear it in the mainstream. And the idea is that Chicago is more violent than Iraq. So it's already a complicated, not entirely accurate notion to use that term, but embracing a term like that to say, hey, we are violent and we like that, and we're going to have T-shirts around it, and then we have Spike Lee have his movie with the same name, which also, in my opinion, didn't really get behind some of the issues that we see with violence focused on the Inglewood neighborhood on the South Side. And so there has been pushback to say, you know, this is not who we are. We shouldn't be embracing this. And this does not by any means tell the story of Black Chicago.
That's Natalie Moore, who's joining us. She's the author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. And I should say, thanks for making time to join us, because you're still on maternity leave, if
yes.
people can hear.
I hope that the crying baby in the background has stopped, if anyone heard.
No, not at all. I just wanted to explain the context for everybody who was listening. You know, Natalie, I think in many ways you wrote this book, not just for Chicago, but for people everywhere to understand the city's South Side. So I wanted to ask you first what you want people to know as a journalist who's covered the city. What do you think is important for people to know?
I've actually evolved since I wrote the book. Well, my thesis, first and foremost, is that until we address segregation, we are going to continue to be a city and a region of inequities. Chicago is unique because it is a diverse city, but it is so segregated. And when I talk about the problems in some of these communities, and this goes back to hyper-segregation, it also goes back to bad housing policies in the 20th century that promoted white flight, and it promoted whites moving to the suburbs by favoring loans. The GI Bill favored whites with home ownership. The FHA favored white suburbs and created a path for white flight. And even though that happened, you know, in the last century, we're still seeing the effects of that, and we're still seeing some deleterious housing policies that are affecting our neighborhoods and have really obliterated a generation of black wealth, because that's how we're taught to build wealth in this country, is through home ownership. So there's a little bit of history that's in the book, but there's also, you know, what do we look like now? Since the book has come out, some of the negative feedback from people who have not read the book has been, oh, well, if black people were just better parents, black neighborhoods are vast wastelands. And these are from white internet commenters who have never been to these neighborhoods. And so that's just another example of how segregation can allow for these stereotypes. But I also want people to think about their own housing choices, even if they live outside of the city of Chicago. If you live in Naperville, or if you live in Deerfield, or you live in the North Shore, there's a reason why you were able to move there, and it's not just, oh, well, I saved money and I bought a house. You know, there was federal policy that allowed for those type of communities to be built, and there's a reason why you decided to live there. And so one thing I would like is for people to start thinking about their own housing choices, because the root of segregation goes back to how communities are created and housing policies.
There's a really interesting statistic that you have, Robert Sampson, found that in Chicago, gentrification stopped when neighborhoods were 40% black. Like, there's just sort of this point where, given the percentage of how many black people there are in the neighborhood, gentrification actually slows down.
Yeah, and there's a lot of gentrification is a hot topic in the city of Chicago, and sometimes I think that it's a misused word. There certainly are areas that are experiencing gentrification, but that is not really the story of what's happening in Chicago neighborhoods. And there have been other studies out there, too, that show that black neighborhoods on the South Side of Chicago don't gentrify. And there was one study that compared Pilsen to Bronzeville that I write about. And Pilsen is a Mexican-American area on the South Side that's been going through a lot of change. And so that neighborhood was seen as, oh, well, that's ethnic fun. That's Mexican tacos and margaritas. And Bronzeville was still seen as a violent place, and those are black people. And there's another statistic that I have in one of the chapters about how about perceptions of neighborhoods. And if there's a black neighborhood that meets the criteria of whites as far as good schools, stable community, and all the things that you know, these white families might be looking for, they still will not choose that neighborhood if it is mostly black.
Natalie, what do you want people to know? We just have about a minute left before we take a break, but what do you want them to know from the perspective of someone who was born and raised on the South Side of Chicago?
To move beyond the stereotypes and to realize that these are places with real people that have real challenges that have been codified ever since really black people arrived in the city from the Great Migration. And having an equitable city means equity for everyone. You know, if you're white and you live on the north side and you think that this isn't your problem, you know, there is a burden of segregation that affects an entire city and an entire region.
That's Natalie Moore. She's taking part in Chicago's Printers Row Lit Fest, actually, this Sunday. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with her. She's the author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. If you have questions or comments, you can always join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, and we'll pick up this conversation in just a few minutes.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Chicago is known as one of the most segregated cities in America. How much does Chicago's segregation reflect simply 21st segregation in this country? We've been talking about that with WBEZ Chicago journalist Natalie Moore, whose new book is called The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. She's taking part in Chicago's Printers Row Lit Fest and will be speaking there this Sunday, but joins us now. And if you have questions or comments for Natalie, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to Creel in Champaign. Hi, Creel. Welcome to the 21st. What's your question or comment?
Hi, Nyla. I'm glad that you're giving us such a diverse coverage for our area. It really matters. I have a question for Ms. Moore. She repeatedly says that the blacks in South Chicago have faced challenges, quote unquote, especially with accruing financial wealth and having been segregated as far as banking and being able to make progress. My question is, how does this excuse the shootings and the deaths? There really is no excuse. I'm poor and I haven't killed anybody. Could she bring that forward and maybe discuss what the cultural difference is, where this has occurred, why that has occurred in South Chicago?
Thanks for that call, Creel. Natalie?
A little trouble hearing her, but what I did hear was that she's poor and has never killed anybody.
Correct.
So that's the other thing about some of these neighborhoods on Chicago's South and West Side, is that they can be looked at as that this is what all people are doing, or most of people are doing. The people who are committing violence, it is a very small number. And a lot of it is interpersonal violence, people who know each other. So, you know, I would never say, oh, well, because this is a poor neighborhood, that's an excuse for gun violence. It's not an excuse, but it's also part of the reason if you have neighborhoods that don't have, you know, jobs or options for people, they are going to turn to other means. But that said, it is still a very small population that is doing this, and I would never say that, you know, all poor people, or if you're poor, that means that you're going to turn to violence. So while I talked about the current policies and historic policies that have shaped these neighborhoods and have left them troubled, there's also the piece about access to guns. And yes, you know, personal responsibility is important. You know, I would never, you know, excuse anyone who is shooting someone. But I do sometimes cringe at that being the first go-to.
Natalie, what percentage...
It makes it sound like all black communities are filled with black people who don't have any morals when we're talking about just a handful of people.
Right. I mean, when we think about what percentage of it, and actually I think the New York Times actually covered a little bit of this in their coverage this weekend, actually, there is a statistic, and I wonder if you could help me out. I don't know if you know the exact one, but what percentage of the violence is committed in those crimes by, I guess, what percentage of the population it represents, if we're thinking about neighborhoods?
I don't have that stat offhand, but you know, I can just say that it's small. And a lot of the violence, too, is people kill people who they know, and they kill people in proximity to them. And that's a general rule of thumb, you know, not just with Chicago. And so, you know, the relationships are intertwined. And at one point, the Chicago Police Department was even trying to predict who would be a victim or a perpetrator of gun violence based on the same kind of analytics that may be used for social media.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into some of the background of what you said about housing policies. And I think we have to start this, though, with just a migration pattern point to sort of to remind people, because so much of this book is also about your family story. And I've actually known you for a really long time, and I don't think I knew that your grandmother was born in Springfield. I wanted to ask you how much of your family story is a reflection of the Great Migration.
Well, I'm a granddaughter of the Great Migration, and I wouldn't be here if it weren't for them. I wouldn't have lived my own South Side experience. My mother's parents came from Georgia after World War II. My grandmother came here first because she had two cousins who were living in Woodlawn, and that's typically how migration happened. You had a relative who was already here, and then you follow. And then my grandfather... they were childhood sweethearts. He came after he finished his service in the war. It was between Harlem and Chicago, but my grandmother was in Chicago, so he came to the South Side. And on my father's side, we actually had some relatives here before the Great Migration, and we're not really sure why. You know, a lot of time mapping our history as Black Americans can be pretty tough. But my grandfather came from Nashville. He ran away from home because he was sick of the racism in the South, and he came to live with his grandmother and his great aunt who had already been here. He had two brothers who had to flee Nashville because of racial violence, and my grandfather, who was younger, felt like he just didn't want to possibly suffer that himself, so he came here to Chicago. And so my grandparents all you know, worked hard. They became homeowners. They helped build the sturdy working black middle class that we see in many, many neighborhoods here in Chicago.
Well, and I wanted to talk about that because I first wanted to ask you what you want people to know about your childhood growing up in Chatham. There's a part of the book where you start actually the book talking about the Cosby Show and the Huxtables and sort of how America was obviously clearly before what we know now about Bill Cosby, very enraptured with this notion of affluent black America.
Yeah. You know, as a child, I may not have had the words to articulate what I was seeing as far as racial disparities, but I knew that black people suffer from stereotypes and black communities did. And I grew up in a stable black middle-class neighborhood called Chatham. And, you know, my parents went to college. I had friends who went to, you know, who were smart in school. You know, there were lots of civic organizations in the neighborhood, a lot of black-owned businesses. You know, it was a great place, and I remember feeling like this isn't reflected in news coverage because, as I mentioned earlier with the violence coverage, you know, it's amped up, but it's pretty much been the same, that a lot of these communities are only covered through that lens. And I knew that my community and many communities like that that was not the story of Black Chicago.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was, we talked about this just before the break about Black homeowners and Black middle-class homeowners and wealth and a comparison of wealth among Black Americans versus white Americans. And there are a lot of complex reasons for that. But I thought we should start with something. Your dad calls it the Black tax, as you write about in the book. What's that?
If you live in a Black neighborhood, your home value is going to be valued less, even if it's similar to a white home in a white neighborhood. You may have fewer goods and services in your neighborhood, such as grocery stores or retail. At some of those stores, you may be paying higher prices because of that. And one thing that I say over and over again in the book is that this is not a class issue. This is a race issue. During the housing boom of the 2000s, a neighborhood like Chatham, saw a rise in home values as other neighborhoods did. But it turns out that there were lending institutions that were purposefully giving bad loans and risky loans to Black people simply because they're Black. And then people may remember that Attorney General Lisa Madigan sued Countrywide because of their discriminatory, predatory practices in Black and Latino communities and won a huge settlement. So even though I'm talking about the past, we still see things that are happening today. And so why am I connecting the dots on this? If you get a neighborhood that's full of foreclosures or a neighborhood that was stable that has foreclosures and vacancies, that can attract crime, that can attract elements into those buildings. It can create, vacant lots are ripe for, hiding drugs or doing crime. It erodes the stability of the communities. And then you had unemployment in some of these places. So you really had neighborhoods that were traditionally stable that were rocked, as well as ones that were low income that were rocked.
One thing that I think is really interesting is you actually write about the Obamas and their tax returns as a comparison of wealth. And pre-White House, how do you think the Obamas' tax returns reflect a typical picture of Black wealth versus white wealth in this country?
This is when they were living in a condo. This was before Obama's book came out, and they lived in Hyde Park. And even though they were a six-figure income household, they did not their portfolio did not mirror those of their white peers of similar income. They mirrored Black households with lower income. And that's because they paid a marriage penalty because Michelle Obama earned close to what her husband earned and sometimes more. And Black women have traditionally worked outside of the home and have been income earners, and the marriage penalty doesn't account for that. They also did not diversify their wealth. They didn't have stocks and bonds and dividends and things like that. They had their wealth only in their condo.
As we're talking about segregation, we've talked about housing, but I think one of the things we always think about, sort of, maybe it's kind of in the back of our mind, but you really sort of lay out all the details of this, is how segregation impacts education. And there's a line you have in the book, Chicago's a multiracial city where people aren't learning together or about each other. And I wanted to go to the moment of the historic school closings that happened, it's 2 years ago now, in Chicago, and ask, how much of that was, there was so much outcry from the African-American community about those school closings. And you even write how you were worried about a school closing in your neighborhood because you were worried how it would affect property values. Where are we at with that now? Have there been ideas for those abandoned properties? Have there been ideas for, because our Chicago schools are very segregated right now.
We haven't seen anything totally come to fruition. There have been some sales of buildings. There have been some ideas to turn them into either residential spaces or some type of, business model. But for the most part, these are just empty buildings that are languishing on the city's south and west sides. For me, the point of my chapter was not so much about the school closings, even though I mentioned them, but is about a lack of imagination in promoting integration in Chicago public schools. And research just simply shows that integration is good for blacks, it's good for whites, it's good for all races. And I thought that the school closings could have been an opportunity to do something creative to address that issue. And whenever you, well, whenever I have gone to CPS about integration and segregation, they don't have an answer. They just give me a boilerplate answer. Well, we want everyone to have a high-quality education.
Well, and I think that Well, and I think that reflects in a way, Mayor Emanuel, you make this interesting distinction in the book about Chicago politics today that it's neoliberal. And what do you mean by that, and who do you think loses out most with these, as you're characterizing, like sort of these neoliberal policies?
Neoliberalism is the privatization of a lot of traditional city services. And it's argued that neoliberalism helps people who are more affluent, and it leaves working class and lower income people behind. Parking meters can be looked at as a neoliberal policy, selling the parking meters to get some short-term cash, getting rid of your government workforce or slimming it down to privatize it to other companies when it necessarily hasn't been proven that those companies are going to do a better job than the government workers.
Yeah. How much do you think Chicago segregation echoes, or how much do you think it's maybe a microcosm or a reflection of the entire country?
Well, that's why I have American in my subtitle, because I'm writing about Chicago, but we see this happening in many other cities across the United States, particularly in the Midwest and the Northeast. The one thing that has come out of the uprisings in Ferguson and Baltimore is that I think there is more conversation happening about segregation and the conditions and communities that lead to people wanting to revolt, whether it's against police brutality or bad housing.
Natalie, we just have about 2 minutes left, and you end the book by saying journalists are not often solution-oriented. So I wanted to offer to you a question about how you recommend, first of all, before we even get to solutions, just how we should be thinking about segregation in this country, not just the costs, but how we should really be taking a more nuanced approach to this.
I think we first have to acknowledge it in a real way. I write that segregation in Chicago is like air and water. It just is. We don't think about it. We just accept that this is how our city is. And I believe if we stop and think about why it is, that's the first step in understanding our communities. It's not simply saying, well, yeah, we're segregated. That's just how it is. Well, why is it that way? And why do we accept it?
That's Natalie Moore. She's the author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. She's going to be at Printers Row Festival in Chicago this Sunday afternoon. We tweeted out those links. If you want more information on that, you can follow the 21st show. But Natalie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on the 21st show, we'll be talking about politics. Brian Mackey joins us from WUIS to give us a preview of what's ahead for the week, what you missed over the weekend. You can always reach us, by the way, and send us feedback. You can email us and or send us, give us a call, leave us a voicemail. All that information is on our website. It's www.21stshow.org. So head there for all of our contact information and stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com. We'll be right back.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. On Mondays, we like to take a few minutes to catch you up on politics in Illinois, which you missed over the weekend, and give you an idea of what's ahead for the week. As we know, legislators are back in Springfield for the day on Wednesday. Governor Rauner has been road tripping and keeping up his attacks on Democrats for not passing a budget. And superintendents are sending the governor a letter demanding funding for schools. Brian Mackey covers state government and politics for WUIS, and he's back with us from their studios in Springfield. Brian, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
So we've got no budget deal. We still have Democrats and Governor Rauner and other Republicans. Everybody's pointing the fingers at each other. Schools, universities, social service agents are all trying to figure out what this means. And this sounds really familiar, but I wonder if you can put in context for us, how does the situation in the state right now compare to where we were a year ago at this time?
Well, you've had a year of a lot of social service agencies getting zero money. You've had a year of the political leaders continuing to say some fairly nasty things about each other, particularly from Governor Rauner directed at, as he likes to say it, House Speaker Madigan and the politicians he controls, sort of denigrating them for 30 years of driving Illinois into the toilet, I believe, is one of the metaphors he used last week. On the other hand, you have Democrats who have been hitting back at the governor, saying he wants to hurt the middle class with his policies. You have so much more uncertainty now for a lot of people. Even outfits that have gotten funding, like a year ago, schools, I guess they didn't know yet, but there was a budget that the Democrats had passed sitting on the governor's desk, and the governor would ultimately sign the money for elementary and high schools in Illinois. And so they were able to open on time. Now there is no budget sitting on the governor's desk for him to veto or not.
Right.
So it's just sort of an open question.
Right. So it's a good reminder that last year, at least, we did have a budget that ultimately ended up funding at least schools. You know, Governor Rauner, and I want to get to the schools in just a minute, but I wanted to ask you first just about the rhetoric that we're hearing, because Governor Rauner has been traveling the state, blasting Democrats, as you've said, for not even bringing a budget proposal to him before the end of the session. Certainly, there's no shortage of rhetoric on either side here. How is that playing into things?
Well, I would imagine that it's certainly goes to the question of trust, right? We hear a lot about, is there trust at the highest levels in Illinois government to make a deal? And from what we're hearing, no, there isn't. Because you have, on the one hand, the governor comes out and says, I want to negotiate in good faith. We're putting offers on the table. Look, the governor is now advocating for this stopgap budget that would at least help Illinois limp along until the end of the year with partial funding for its programs. And then on the other hand, when the House Republican organization is out there taking out television and internet ads against some of their targets, some Democratic legislators that they want to defeat. Now, yes, that sort of back and forth and campaigning over policy is part of the political process, but I think it goes to this idea, well, you say you want to work with us and compromise with us on the one hand, and then you are just beating us over the head out there in the public with your message and your television advertisements and those sort of things. There's something of a disconnect there.
Well, and you mentioned the television advertisements. I know the Illinois House Republican Organization has been running attack ads against Southern Illinois Democrats, and there was an investigation by WISL-TV that found a link from that organization back to the governor. What do we know about this money trail?
Yeah, I mean, basically, no surprise, Governor Rauner has invested millions and millions of dollars in the Republican Party in the state. Some have even described it as basically a takeover. We saw when he, became governor and started funneling money in, there's a new party chairman of the Republican Party, and it really is sort of the Bruce Rauner's party at this point. So even if you have to trace back a few steps. So he gives $5 million to the state Republican Party, and they give a few million dollars to the House Republican organization. It basically all leads back to Governor Rauner.
As you've mentioned, there's no budget this year. There's also no funding yet for grade schools and for high schools. We saw today school superintendents in the state sending a letter to the governor accusing him of not doing enough to support the most vulnerable students. And we know that schools are in a really tough spot headed into the fall. Do we have any sense if a letter like this will increase pressure on either party to do something?
Well, I'm going to sound like a bit of a broken record here, but I'm just not sure what could possibly increase pressure more than we've had it, short of the schools actually not opening. And you had an excellent interview last week with former Governor Jim Edgar, where he talked about actually passing a budget now would really alleviate the pressure and potentially delay the kind of real solution that everybody knows needs to happen. I mean, the governor himself has acknowledged we need both spending cuts and new revenue. Now, he won't say exactly what sort of tax hikes he would agree to, but he has agreed sort of in general to tax hikes if the Democrats go along with his partisan agenda that he wants to push, which, of course, Democrats are say they're not willing to do. But this idea of, well, let's, you know, pity the school children. Well, I'm sorry, but this is the consequence. If you want to say no budget until an agenda passes, you know, part of me wants to say, well, let's just see what that really looks like. And then you can ask the voters, okay, should we not open the schools until we get these, you know, workers' compensation reform? Is it worth that? Should we not open the schools until the legislators enact term limits and other sort of things the governor is trying to do? I thought former Governor Edgar had a really interesting point there where he said, if you pass a stopgap budget, it does really alleviate the pressure. To your other question about whether this, you know, a letter will work to sway things, ultimately, I remain doubtful about just about anything swaying things until, you know, something does, and then we're all proven wrong.
We're going to be speaking about school funding on the show later this week, so tune in. We've got a couple school superintendents who are going to be talking to us about that letter, and we're also looking a little more into the funding situation for schools, so that's going to be on the show later this week. Brian, you know, I wanted to ask you, we've had a couple days to settle after all of the drama of last week. Are there any bills that actually did go to the governor's desk? Let's just kind of remove all of the budget stuff for now. Are there any bills that did go to the governor's desk that stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of things on different fronts that are moving forward here. We saw an expansion, or I guess an extension is the better term, of the medical marijuana program that was set to expire, I think, next year. Don't quote me on that. And now it's going to be going.
It was the calendar end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but now it's, I think it's got a 3-year extension. They also expanded the eligibility there. We saw some movement on sticking with the marijuana theme to decriminalize or at least make a petty offense instead of an arrestable offense, possession of small amounts of marijuana. There are a number of other criminal justice things that are sort of small, and the governor's commission on criminal justice is still meeting and discussing the really potentially big changes that they might recommend. But small things like right now, if you go to prison, it can be very difficult to get a license to even do a job like cutting hair or doing nails or something, mm-hmm. which are licensed professions in Illinois. There was some legislation that passed that should make it easier for people who have at least nonviolent convictions to be able to find a job. I mean, we train, it's kind of crazy, we train people to cut hair in the prisons, and then you can't get a license to do it when you get out. So things like that have passed. And, you know, despite all the, as you mentioned, this sort of public drama about the budget, the legislature is going about its job for, you know, the other 99% of the bills that are passing. It's just that big one is drawing so much attention away from the other things they're doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. We did see the prison phone calls. I know that was one thing that Carol Ammons was working really hard on, and that happening. Let me ask you about this summer session. Do we know what that's going to look like? I know House Speaker Madigan had put out a calendar for the summer calendar was sent out last week. We know that the House plans to be in session every Wednesday at noon starting this week. Do we know what the Senate calendar looks like right now, or when lawmakers are going to be back?
Off the top of my head, I don't remember the next time the Senate is in, and I'm just checking the website, and they don't seem to have a next date scheduled. Of course, the way, I don't want to get too wonky here, but when they adjourned, they just adjourned to what's called to the call of the chair. So,
what does that mean?
The Senate president could just say at any moment, basically, yeah, we're going to reconvene now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like we're just going to put things on hold. They didn't, you know, they don't.
So they didn't really adjourn.
Right. They don't have to call a special session or anything like that. They could come back at any time, but I think they point out that, you know, while it may look good to have everybody here in Springfield, these negotiations don't require all 177 senators and representatives here to do it. There are much smaller groups that are working on these details, and then they present them to their colleagues to vote on. And so there's not a lot of sense in having everybody sitting in Springfield, just getting angry with each other or anything like that, is what the argument is anyway.
I wonder if you can give a sense for our listeners who are outside of Springfield, or for the folks in Springfield who aren't venturing down to the state house. Just from our neck of the woods here, it seems like it's kind of everybody had a really tough week last week. A lot of people left town. Is anyone around right now?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of other stuff going on in Springfield other than the state government, or the state, I should say. There's plenty of state government still functioning other than the actual state political apparatus, right? I mean, we have so many state agencies.
Sure, no, I'm in the state house, though.
Yeah, but in the state house, there are plenty of people who still go to work every day in there. And I think that, in the broader community, there is a lot of worry here that I don't know if that's shared in quite as many other places about, there are so many businesses here that are dependent on state government for contracts and things. And I think everybody is just kind of holding their breath to see what happens.
Is there a scheduled time for how long they'll be in session on Wednesday, the House?
That's tough to say. I don't think, no. Generally, they just announce the time they're coming in and move from there. And if there are things to do, they sometimes have busy work. If there are not things to do, then it may not be a very long session.
I just want to ask you one last question before we wrap. I know the AP, as you were talking about business owners being worried, the AP is reporting there's some programs for at-risk teens that are being cut because of the budget, and that's having a direct effect on some areas. There were several teens arrested around Rockford that were once part of this Redeploy Illinois program. Do we know, if you can mention just briefly, any other ongoing effects of the budget standoff before we go?
Yeah, I mean, the human service advocates will tell you tons of them that rape crisis centers have shut down and stopped taking new clients. I've heard that if you call there's a suicide prevention hotline, I guess, and if you call that, you may have a six-month wait to talk to a counselor, which I gather is not exactly the way you want to go about trying to prevent somebody who's in immediate crisis. You mentioned the case in Rockford. That was one of the earliest examples of the state budget shutdown really having an effect on criminal justice programs, which of course the governor has said is a big priority of his. But we see that these budget problems have consequences. The youth were turned out of this program, and as you pointed out, there's a news report that some of them are now coming to the attention of law enforcement, whereas previously this redeploy program has been quite successful. They use evidence-based methods. They work with kids to keep them out of trouble, and it theoretically prevents costs to both the state and to society down the line, and that's something that has been suffering in the budget impasse.
That's Brian Mackey from WUIS. He covers state government and politics, joining us from Springfield. Thanks, Brian.
Have a good week.
That's all the time we have for today. On tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking parenting tips with Shefali Sabari. She's a clinical psychologist and author of the new book, The Awakened Parent. She writes that although being a parent is linked to our biology, being a good parent is anything but a natural phenomenon. We're going to hear from Shefali about her mindful approach to parenting. We're produced by Christine Herman, Travis Stansel, Austin Keating, and Ben Thomas Payne. Technical direction comes from Steve Mork. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their help with the show. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st, and we love feedback. You can email us, leave us a voicemail, or Facebook message us. All of those links are on our website, 21stshow.org. Scott Cameron is our news director. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.